Thank you for coming over here, Ryan. This is being recorded right now on the 1st of December. I am really sick. I have been in and out of bed all day. I've got a cold. You're not feeling sick at all?
I am feeling great.
You feel great?
Hopefully I don't get a cold from you.
Yeah, hopefully you do not. This one's pretty gross. I think it's just the cold weather, man. it's getting really wet, really cold out here in Seoul. So this recording that we did for the podcast that's going to be played, this was recorded, I want to say, like 2 months ago?
Yeah,
is that right?
2 months ago. That sounds right
to
me. Yeah.
And so this recording, I think, was actually one of our best ones yet. We interviewed Jean He from UIU. She is the co-owner of the team UIU, which is a very new esports team that was founded in 2017. We talk about a lot of interesting stuff in this podcast. I think you guys are really, really going to like this. This is one of those people where just a few minutes into the conversation, you think, oh, this person's very smart. And we had a really interesting conversation. Do we have any announcements or anything we need to make, Ryan?
We're going to be having a December Patreon update coming within the next two weeks. So people can be on the lookout for that.
Okay. And there's nothing else for me for the whole year. So I got sick right on time, man. We finished the KSL finals, and I can lay around my house and feel horrible until I recover. The holiday season is here. Christmas music is playing now in the grocery store. Do you not like Christmas music?
It's too uppity for me, man. Like, it's too cheerful. Like, I don't have that.
Okay, for
it grinds me down. I can't handle it.
No, for some reason, man, I actually enjoy Christmas music now.
Really?
Yeah. If it's Christmas time and the lights are out, I do not mind it. It gets me in a good mood. I'm getting more festive as I get older. I think I'm appreciating holidays more and more. As always, guys, support on Patreon goes a long way. It really does make a huge difference for us over here in Seoul as we continue to produce and develop this show. So if you can give us support on Patreon, it's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. Even a small donation really does go a long way for us. It's really appreciated. And I guess that does it for introing the show. Now you're going to hear a not sick version of me from 2 months ago with Jeannie. Enjoy. So you grew up in Seoul for a very little bit and then you moved abroad. Is that correct?
Yes. So I was born in Seoul and I moved to Cincinnati, Ohio in 1969.
But now you're based in London, right?
I am. I'm supposed to be living in London, but I'm rarely there.
Yeah. And when did you go to London?
I think it was 2010.
2010.
Mm-hmm.
So you're about as international as you can get then. I mean, this is...
Yes, I've been... Okay, so born in Seoul, moved to Cincinnati, went to school in Cambridge, then worked in Boston, New York, lived in Cambridge, England for a while. Then I think Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, Hawaii, and then London. So, yeah, I might have missed a place.
That's crazy. So, do you identify with one location in the world more than another?
I would say I feel like I'm a Midwestern girl because that's where I, you know, my formative years. But then I kind of call Hawaii home too. I lived there for close to 9 years, and there's something about that place that speaks to my heart. And so I still, even though I've lived now in London for, I think, longer, I think of it as home.
Where do you end up spending most of your time?
On an airplane.
Do you feel like you've gotten, you enjoy traveling more now, or you enjoy, I mean, the commute, by the way, more or less now? Because I used to love airports when I was a kid in Kansas. Like, I thought, you can get on an airplane.
So exciting, right?
Yeah, I thought you can get on an airplane and go anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And now I sort of, I find like a going to an airport like a such a chore.
So my husband said a funny thing like a long time ago when we were much younger. He says, tell the kids, be careful what you wish for. It might come true. And because he said when he was young, he always wished that he could like travel around the world and stay in fancy hotels. And so his career necessitated that. He's like, I think to your point, like anything when you have to do it for too much. But I still enjoy, I enjoy the destination.
Yeah,
the travel's hard, But I mean, you're going for a reason, and whether it's an event or something. So I enjoy once I'm there and meeting all the people and all that. So
yeah, no, I appreciate travel, especially as I get older, more and more. But there's something about airports that I just tend to be like, oh man, it's hard to get through, you know?
I think also back before, travel was a little bit nicer. And then now, yeah, with all the restrictions and the way that
security,
and then how, like, you have to pay for everything, you know? I mean,
yeah, like if you have service, an extra bag, you know,
the service is, it just makes it really unpleasant. But I think maybe like 20 years ago, it was still a little bit more, it's cool to be flying.
Is that more just US airlines, or is that?
I think so, because when I fly the Asian ones, which I try to book those if I'm coming out here, it's just, service is just so much better. And then you get like your two bags and you get free meals. And
I've always felt like there's something super aggressive about American Airlines. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like lately, or I guess post 9/11. Have you experienced that? Right?
Don't ever talk back, or don't ever look the wrong way at a flight attendant, kind of thing. So
you've been working in esports now, or gaming now, for some time, but you have a long history before you. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because most of my viewers are from StarCraft, so mm-hmm. they might not be as familiar with UIU.
No, yeah, because we're generally in the fighting game community. So
right.
Prior to co-founding UIU, I've had, since I am much older than most of your listeners, I've had a varied career. So started off after university in management consulting. And then from there, went into fashion. So went and got a degree in fashion design. And yes, from giving advice to Fortune 100 companies on strategy, I went to like designing menswear at Ralph Lauren back in the late 80s. And then after that, I was talking about the traveling, moved to London, and then Cambridge, England, and then out to Singapore and those places. And so there I was kind of raising children, so I had three kids. And then after that, when we moved to Hawaii, I got a law degree and was practicing corporate law. And at the same time, I developed an early learning curriculum. That's for like workbooks and things for kind of the preschool kindergarten kids. And from that, that's when the App Store opened. If you can think all the way back to when the first iPod Touch came out, even before the phone, I thought it was a really interesting way for young children to practice their motor skills, because you could draw on the interface. So developed some of the first like learning apps for that technology. So it started started my journey into a little bit of tech. This is a long story, guys, so hang in there.
No, please. And
then I moved to London. And when I moved to London, got a job developing a bunch of like mobile games with a gaming company there. And it seems like I like to multitask. So at the same time as that, I started my own startup too. And it was kind of a fashion shopping app that used location on your phone and the photos and everything to like kind of see inside of stores that were around you and shop within that. So did that, moved out to Silicon Valley just because of the funding and whatnot. So did that for several years, and then that startup got acquired. And then after that was kind of mentoring other founders and thinking about, you know, interesting areas to go into. And then that's when UIU kind of happened.
So how long has UIU been around?
Just a little bit over 2 years.
Over 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
You're working in a part of gaming that I find, for like quote unquote outsiders, it's hard to penetrate. It's hard to get into.
Mm.
Why fighting games?
Mm. There's a lot of different reasons, but it kind of, one of the reasons goes back to why we ended up in the U.S. from Korea. My father taught martial arts to the U.S. Army back in the early 60s. And he was invited by the ROTC program in Cincinnati to come over and teach them martial arts. So that's why we ended up in Cincinnati. So from the time I was born, I've just kind of, martial arts has been a part of my life. He helped bring Taekwondo to the U.S. Whenever I drive through small towns in the U.S. and I see Taekwondo schools in the smallest city in, you know, in Texas or something, I know that my father was one of the people that was responsible for bringing that over. So my weekends were spent going to tournaments. He would either throw them himself or we'd be traveling to other cities and you know, helping with the tournaments. So when I, with fighting games, even though it's, you know, it's in the arcades or it's on your PS4 or something, there's something that's just like, you know, resonates with me because I just grew up with that all the time. It's 1v1. It's super easy to understand. Like, even though I don't really play that stuff, I can understand what's going on and I can appreciate. Since some of the other games for someone that's not actively playing that game is a little bit difficult to understand, right? So anyway, so I have the background in like martial arts and it kind of transferred to there. And Drew, my co-founder, has also been a really big fan of fighting games, of MMA, all of that type of stuff. So we're just naturally drawn to that. I really like the community. I found that the community was incredibly diverse, socioeconomically. It's just super global. It's very inclusive. Well, I'm looking at the positive side of everything. It was very inclusive, gender, race, all of that. And so for me, I found that really, I was really attracted to that. It's a very close-knit community too, a lot of grassroots activities. And so that also resonated with me. And like I said, it's 1v1. I thought it'd be really interesting to tell personal stories with the players. One of the things that we were really interested in was creating interesting life content around gaming and around the players, the people around, not just the players, content creators, the casters, whatever, right? And I think it's a lot easier to do when you choose a genre that is 1v1. And so that's just there's a few of the reasons.
Did you connect more with a specific fighting game or was it FGC in general? Like, were you more into Tekken or Street Fighter or?
I think just even like when I was in college and they had like the cabinets and the dining hall and things and the folks were playing like the Street Fighters and whatnot. And so, you know, that I think Street Fighter and more Tekken, like I think Tekken's a beautiful game. And so when I watch it, I could watch it for hours and hours. Some of them are a little harder for me to, to understand, or some of them it's, my team always teases me because like Mortal Kombat, it's so violent. So that when we picked up our first, when we were scouting for some players.
Sorry, please don't cover your mouth. Sorry.
Yeah. So when we were scouting for Mortal Kombat players, and I was like, I'm sorry, guys, but I'm just not going to be able to watch them because it's so gory.
Have you seen the, you know, the fatalities, right?
Where they murdered? Yes. So then I'll our players are doing really well. I'm sitting there trying to cheer them on and I close my eyes and I can still hear like what's happening because the blood's like, and
it's like, ah. That's a game that absolutely stayed true to what it started out as. I think that's banned in Korea.
Probably.
It's banned. It's banned most countries. They do not give a fuck, man. They're still doing what they're doing. To go back to what we were talking about earlier, there's so many different fighting games.
Yes.
It seems like, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this or not, but it seems like out of all the genres that there are, so, you know, shooting games, MOBA games, mm-hmm. It seems like fighting games, there's the least, in my opinion, and from my view, and I do RTS, but the least amount of tribalism. Would you agree with that? It seems like in fighting games, even though everybody who plays their fighting game thinks theirs is the best,
yeah,
and theirs is the most difficult and takes the most skill, it seems like there's an understanding that everybody's got to stick together in FGC. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why it's called the fighting game community.
Right, right.
There's the word community in there.
Right.
They don't have that in MOBAs. Like if you talk to Dota players or League players,
uh-huh,
it's like the other side is alien. Do you have any ideas on why that is the case in fighting games?
Maybe they have to stick together because, maybe because they're, it is grassroots, it's smaller numbers. And so, I'll probably offend some people, but like if you're not like at the cool kids table, maybe you have to band together. Like you're not Overwatch, you're not this, and like, I don't know. But I think it also speaks to that it is so like diverse and inclusive and it is like community driven. So it's hard to just stay siloed in, like if you're a Tekken player or if you're a Street Fighter player, you need to kind of pull all of those games together in order to have enough mass to like put on some local tournaments or something like that. And yeah.
Do you think that's all publisher related as well? I've always felt like, and I'm not obviously not anti-publisher, but it seems like the game publishers are more aloof or have been more aloof in fighting games than compared to like, let's say Riot, for instance, which Riot is completely hands-on in control of their one game.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like fighting game publishers, historically at least, not as much.
I think they've let the community drive a lot of the activity. So, you know, they publish the games, but then in terms of the tournaments and all of that, it's really has grown from the users and the local communities. And, you know, I think things are, maybe will change in the future. I don't know if you've kind of heard all the rumors about the Riot fighting game and whatnot. And
I've heard about that. Mm-hmm. They're going to be releasing a fighting game. And I don't know what's going to happen. I'm so curious about this. I mean, I'm based in Seoul. League is insanely big out here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going to happen, but they're going to drop a fighting game.
So that's the word on the street. So yeah. And then even Capcom has been experimenting with different formats in addition to their Pro Tour that they have. So this past year, they tried the Street Fighter Leagues in Japan and also in the U.S. And I think there's been a lot of learnings and success from that. And next year, you'll probably see, you know, a second iteration of that. So I think there's more. Now there's starting to be a bit more involvement besides just having the pro tours. But even outside the pro tours, it's still so much community driven. For instance, like Tekken, this year they created this dojo system. I don't know if you heard about that, but
can you explain that for the people listening?
Yeah. So before with the pro tour, you had like the master events, which give you a lot more points, and then the challengers, which were a little were regional. And I think my thinking is that they wanted to grow the communities, the local communities, right, and also give a lot of players that don't have the resources to be flying all around the world to collect these points, opportunities also get some points. So they came up with a system called the Dojo, and any local tournament organizer can put on a tournament, and depending on how many entrants you have, you get certain number of points for that, right? So we just threw one yesterday here in Korea, and we did we capped it at 64 because the venue was rather small. We wanted everyone to be comfortable, but the winner of that got dojo points that went towards the finals for the world tour. So I think things like that are really wonderful, and speaks to like the whole like building of community. It gives local tournament organizers a chance to organize a tournament, prove themselves. Maybe if they do a great job and the community gets behind them, next year they might get a chance at being a challenger event, and then also the local community to for them that the folks that don't have the resources to like travel out of state or whatnot, to get really good tournament experience. So I think it's really wonderful, and it really speaks to like the fighting game community. I hope more publishers kind of try that approach.
Yeah, there's this interesting relationship that like publishers have with the people that play their games, where it's like, you know, they make the game, but then these other people sort of take over and become essentially more knowledgeable about the game, more centered on the game than even the people that made the game. And there's always this, I don't even know where I stand on this, but, you know, it's fascinating to see how much control publishers exhibit versus how much they kind of like let people go with it. But now with esports having so much money, competitive gaming having so much money involved, it's going to be fascinating to kind of see where each of these publishers goes and how much control they exhibit. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me like so far fighting game publishers have exhibited less control. Is that over their community, less guidelines, less restrictions in broadcasts? Do you have an opinion on that? Is that good or bad or what?
Yeah, I think except for how they dictate the world tours, they've allowed a lot of the community to come up with events, and you know, the fact that we were able to just throw one too. And I don't know how that's going to go I don't know if they're going to try to with fighting games too, as you were saying, like there's so much money being put into it. Like, I think we're kind of the money's not there in fighting games right now in terms of prize winnings or sponsorships and whatnot. So there's more room for, I guess, experimentation.
Yeah, probably more room for growth. I'm curious because, like, you know, my game is StarCraft, so that's Blizzard Entertainment. And, like, the other guys that I know that work out here, it's all League, right, besides the FGC guys I go. But there's always frustrations with, even though there's money being poured in, how much control a publisher exhibits or them being concerned about the image of the company. Mm-hmm. Like, one thing I find very liberating about fighting games is sort of, or I should say FGC, is how open it is, how real, how raw they are, how real they are, in comparison to something which is quite manicured like League of Legends. And that's not an anti-League statement, but it's like, there's something to that.
Yeah. But that's what's really attractive about the FGC. You can just show all kinds of, that's when I say like it's super diverse, you get the most interesting personalities in there. You know, fun, entertaining, super toxic too. And you just like, you know, super inclusive and super, you just get, it's,
you get
it's,
more characters.
It's, yeah, it's the world, man. It's the world. Yeah. It's like, it's not an aesthetic. Yeah, like what you said, it's not homogenized. It's just.
Yeah, it's not sterilized and watered down.
No, and I think they actually, like when they do these like Street Fighter leagues and things, they try to show all these diverse personalities and like warts and all and stuff. So I think it's super entertaining. It's more like WWE. It's a little
That's
bit
what
more
I was thinking.
Like,
yeah.
Like it's just really underneath.
The theatrics is more real. It's so cool. Like, so just to shift gears here for a second. You're a team owner. You have this incredible brand. It's very new. How does one make that? What does the beginnings of that look like? Like, how do you start that?
How do you start?
Because there's only a couple of these in the world, right? I think for an average person, actually, even a fan of competitive gaming, I think it's hard to conceptualize how somebody sees the beauty, you know, in competitive gaming, and then becomes a powerhouse brand. What does that look like? Like, what are the first steps you take to make that?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, my co-founder Drew has been always an avid follower and fan of the genre, and he got to know certain, I guess, more influential people in the community, and we reached out to a few of them to get some advice, because it is a really, even though it's very like I said, super inclusive and inviting and whatnot. But it's also, if you're an outsider, and they have such a legacy, right? It's been around for decades, and these people have kind of grown up through their local scene and all that. So if you're an outsider, I think sometimes they're a little bit suspicious of like somebody, you know, coming in. So we got some advice from people that are super well respected in the area. But I think because we were coming in initially to about content, like we said, like showing personality and whatnot. And as we were trying to work on that, we realized that we actually started meeting some players online and some of their struggles in order to like try to travel and compete, because like I said, it's not, the prize money's not there. And a lot of them are, you know, driving places, sleeping on the floor type of thing. And so kind of it spoke to my, because I'm a mother, I was like, oh, I need to help these these kids that have these dreams and whatnot. And so we just started, it kind of, it wasn't by design, actually. It kind of happened. I know this is going to sound crazy, but it kind of happened where the first person we kind of sponsored to a tournament, he was just short of a few points to qualify for the finals. And so we were like, oh, let's send you to that last tournament so you can try to qualify. And, you know, just paid for his flight and hotel and all that. And then that led to another person. And so it was me just, well, it was us trying to give some opportunities to people that were just like on the cusp of some of their goals. We realized that like that was very rewarding. Also then that allowed us to have some people to build content around, meaning like stories of these people. We've been watching other players. Our first like international player that we signed was from Korea. And we were just watching like their streams and whatnot. And once again, it's the way we've always operated, was to find people who had a lot of potential and who hadn't gotten the chance to, like we said, travel. Because that's the tournaments are happening all around the world, and you have to pay out of your own pocket to go to these things, right? So for him, like we just saw a lot of potential and saw great personality, and we were nobody. So like I have to really thank the first players who took the leap of faith and like, who are you guys? Like, where are you from? Like and said, okay, yeah, I'll be sponsored by you, right? It took, I think, a big leap of faith to associate with two people who like are outside the community and didn't really have a track record. But great things happened to our early players with the support. I mean, we knew that they had the ability. And so once they had the opportunity to start traveling, they started doing really well. I have great personalities too, so created like a lot of fans in the community. And I think we just grew together that way. And so we're very hands-on, like, we traveled to all the tournaments and were there supporting the players. I just assumed that that's what all team owners do, but I heard that that's not necessarily the case. A lot of times people are like, you're here at the tournament? Like, wow.
Dude, some teams are so aloof I've been working in esports for a long time. I've met some team owners that are so gross.
Oh.
Or so just like, so just there for the money. What's funny is there's not that much money yet to be made.
I was gonna say, like, there's not really money in it.
But,
so.
But you'll see people who think they're gonna, you know, there's some cash grab here and.
I think we're for several more years. It's about building, and you're not gonna really see much return on that investment. Is trying to help the communities grow, so that people do have opportunities, whether they're pro players, content creators, you know, the guys, people doing marketing or business. Like at this point, we need to be investing a lot to grow the ecosystem, to give everybody opportunities. And that if you're thinking that it's like, because you hear like how big the market is or whatever deal, you hear about some brand like sponsoring somebody, and people from the outside are thinking like, yeah, there's all this money. And it's like, No, that's where you see them leave after a year, 6 months or a year, because it's not. You have to invest a lot into this.
This is something that's fascinated me, because I feel like the way... I know the FGC people occasionally don't like it referred to as esports, but just for the sake of having the conversation, let's refer to it as esports. I think the way that it is explained in the media with all this money and all this stuff happening, and then what's actually going on, where it's like maybe 1%, 2% of the people in this ecosystem are actually making a living solely off of this. I don't know. I guess I'm just saying this idea out loud. I'm curious what your thoughts are on it. But I find there's so much falsehood in how esports is reported on.
It's publicly glamorized. It's glamorized. Yeah, yeah. And so coming from another industry, fashion, that's totally glamorized. I mean, that's the job of the media, is to hide all the warts and make everything seem super sexy. So working in fashion, everyone thinks, oh, you're there like, you know, with your little mannequin, and there's fashion shows and models and like, no, that's like maybe 2% of the time, right? 98%, 95 to 98% of the time is just grind work, and it's shit, and it's working with factories and bad, you know, whatever and whatnot. And so, but you don't see, I mean, that's not going to sell magazines.
Right.
Right. And same with, I think, esports. Like, most of the people that are able to make a living out of it are grinding every day. They're hustling so hard.
And they're also not wealthy.
No, no.
The best.
They're getting by.
Yeah. The best that are, the people that are doing okay are rich at best. Mm. Nobody has fuck you money. Mm. I've been so intrigued, because when I see gaming reported in the news, so I'm 35 years old, right? I'm used to, when I was a kid, okay, games are going to cause violence,
right?
And this is dangerous, or it'll destroy your brain somehow, which is totally absurd. Into watching the media now talk about gaming as, this is going to make you rich.
Fortnite.
You're going to make $3 million being a Fortnite.
We're all going to be ninja.
We're all going to be ninja, right? That's a whole other phenomenon that's worth talking about. But there's this whole... a thing that's happening where now it's being reported, instead of it being talked about as, like, for instance, community building, it's stimulating for your brain. Now it's talked about as some sort of like it's Bitcoin or something. These people that are doing this, they're the ones making the money. When in reality, and I've met so many pro gamers, like the best in the world, I've met so many, none of these people are even millionaires. They've made at most a couple hundred thousand in prize money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not clear what you're going to do next. In Ninja, that's another fascinating point to talk about, but he's not even a pro gamer. He's a streamer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also, in a way, kind of edited his personality to be palatable to, like, the Ellen Show or this other stuff. But within esports, it just seems like, and I guess that's what I wanted to ask you, is like, what is going on where people are reporting how, like, quote unquote, well people are doing when that is simply not true?
Right. So it's really interesting in that, let's just say, take the 2 year span that we've been formally, you know, officially in existence. I remember, like, the first sponsor deck that we were working on, we had clips from all these news programs going like, esports, like, laughing at it, and like the talk show hosts, like, laughing about this, like,
these.
Right, yeah, about like, what do you mean, like, playing computer games, getting paid for that, like, yeah, that's ridiculous, that's not a sport. And, you know, and I get that, like, I'm middle-aged, so I get that on my Facebook, where my high school friends are like, but you should tell them to put the computer, you know, turn off the
time
computer
to go outside.
And go outside, that's not a real sport, and all of this. So you go from that narrative just 2 years ago, where they're like laughing about it on CNN or CNBC or like all the talk shows, to now like, especially with the Fortnite stuff, and it's like, and then you get the news about like the valuations of some of the you know, tier one sports teams, and all these celebrities coming in, like Drake and whatnot, investing, and we're talking like billionaires now and all this. So like within that short span of time, the narratives change from what the hell to like, oh yeah, no, everyone wants to be a pro gamer or what. So the news cycle needs stuff, right? And it's just so interesting how it's like just change like that so fast.
It's also odd because, and maybe this is in part the fault of the people that you know, started trying to market esports, but when people talk about esports numbers, they're talking about any competitive game anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, if we were to talk about sports numbers, like, well, that would include American football, cricket, you know, everything. Where, I mean, sure, esports is big, but it's actually segmented into these groups that are oftentimes not that interested in each other.
Yeah. It's the news cycle. It's a new story. Yeah. It's something kind of shiny that they can report about, and like I said, I just, it's their job to glamorize things, and so they'll pick up the success stories, which, I mean, that's what news does, right? So you'll hear about the success stories, or if someone wins a lot of money somewhere, that gets reported, and then the young kids who love gaming, and then they're like, see mom, I told you I can make a living out of it, let me keep playing Call of Duty kind of thing. And so yeah, the reality is though, it's not a lucrative thing right now.
So we're in, this is recorded in South Korea in Seoul, where esports really started. You're an international person, truly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always wondering what people think about with this question. Why is this not bigger in Japan? I mean, Japan is where Nintendo started. I mean, a lot of people in the West would associate Japan with gaming first and foremost, right?
Right.
But it's, esports, competitive gaming, is actually the smallest in Japan.
Right, right.
In the Asia region. Like Thailand is bigger in esports. Right. Or...
It's starting to change. I know when I think of esports, like I've been into a lot of things coming out of Korea for the past 15 years. So like the rise of K-dramas, K-pop, K-beauty, now the food. And I saw what was happening in esports, you know, 10 years ago. And also in Europe, it was kind of picking up. It wasn't a thing in the U.S. I think with Japan, because it was so much of the arcade culture at first, right? And a lot of the games that they developed were these kind of like 1v1, and they didn't have the internet. I think what really shifted that paradigm was in Korea after the financial crisis, where the government then like invested a lot into the infrastructure of the internet, broadband, all of this, And I've heard there was the economy was bad, the kids were staying at home and playing games over the internet, right? And PC bongs and things. And so there was more of like a ecosystem available for more of this like kind of competitive, maybe team gaming, versus like Japan, the arcade culture. It's more like the salarymen and things, like the kids would kind of sneak into the arcades and whatnot. I think also the laws were different. I know that in Japan, there's a strong like anti-gambling law. And so they view prize money and things from competitions, it could kind of get interpreted as gambling, right? And so I know that recently they've had, Jezu was created, they've started working, the government bodies have been starting to work around how to interpret the anti-gambling law and allow for prize money, right? So now you can get pro licenses, like the Street Fighters and Tekken players. They have now gotten pro licenses so that they can actually like take home a lot of prize money. So within the last, especially the last year, we've seen so much more activity in Japan with these great tournaments and fighting games. They just had like a great one with one sport that's a new MMA organization that's come out of Singapore. They threw a giant like festival where they had mixed martial arts, and then they had Tekken and Street Fighter championships happening at the same time too. So I think it's changing now in Japan in that they're starting to embrace it. It's also console culture, whereas like places like Korea, China, Europe is PC culture. And I think a lot of that esports growth was first happening within like PC-based games, whereas Japan is much more console-based.
Yeah, this is so weird. I've only been to Japan one time. I thought when I went to Japan, it was going to be very similar to Korea, and it's totally not.
Very different.
Like, I guess it's fair to say that Korea and Japan are more similar to each other than like if you go to China, for instance, or some other Asian countries, but mm-hmm. they're still totally different culturally. And I guess different attitudes on technology. I found like when I'm in South Korea, like my card will work everywhere. It's easier to get Wi-Fi. I don't know. There's something about, like, for instance, in Japan, companies still use fax machines.
Yes, they handwrite tickets and things.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't. A lot of, yeah.
I don't know if that's why esports isn't as big there as well or not, but it does seem like there's certain cultures where the relationship with technology is different.
And that's ironic because when you think of Japan, you think it's super tech and robotic and all that.
Giant robots.
And it is, but they also have like the way of doing things traditionally too. So it's an interesting mix. But I think they're so near each other, but culturally they're really different. And I would think that actually Korea and China are maybe a little bit more
you would say similar, more similar,
maybe personality wise. I don't know. Koreans are pretty aggressive and in your face, so
yeah, I guess that's true.
They say what's on their mind, and you go to Japan, everything's so polite, and all this in Korea, they're like, you know, if they don't like you, they let you know right away.
So, in the news, have you seen this news with the Hearthstone thing and Blizzard?
Kind of,
and
just I haven't looked really into it, but I know that it's happened.
Yeah, so basically, at risk of opening the gates of hell here, we don't have to have this in the podcast if you don't want to. A Hearthstone player from Hong Kong was banned after winning a tournament. Mm-hmm. He had an interview where he was saying, you know, support Hong Kong, the mm-hmm. revolution of our times. Mm-hmm. And then Blizzard banned him, took his prize money. Mm. The internet went insane. Yes. Is it a 6-month ban now for him? 6-month ban. The commentators, I think, have been unfired or something.
Sure why the commentators got fired, but
from what I understand,
they knew it was going to happen.
They were Taiwanese commentators and sort of knew.
Oh, they were Taiwanese commentators.
Yeah,
Was this tournament in Taiwan?
I believe it was all done remotely. So he was in Hong Kong. You know, they have like webcams.
Right. And the commentators were Taiwanese.
The commentators were in a tiny studio in Taipei.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, there's many people in China watching.
Of course.
This guy said this.
Right.
He got banned. Now, he's been unbanned, but what I was trying to get to is basically, what is your thoughts on China's, I guess, growing control of speech in the world, but also, I guess, speech in gaming as well? Because esports is, I think, literally as international as you can get right now.
Yeah.
There's not anything that's more international than esports, and so this is an international issue.
It's going to be very interesting the next year on how this plays out, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm correct, there's a large Chinese ownership in
Tencent.
Yeah. Right, too, also.
So they have, just for the listeners, so they have shares in I think they own 100% of League of Legends. Riot, I should say. Can you look up how much shares they have in Blizzard? So I know
they're in Riot, right?
They own Riot. Mm-hmm. They have, I want to say, 45% shares in Epic. I don't believe Valve is privately owned, so they don't have any.
So I think it's going to be really interesting because, as I said, I've been traveling a lot, so I haven't really delved into the story. What I glean is just from my Twitter feed of mm-hmm. like reading little blurbs really quickly, that their argument was that he had violated some, you know, like player conduct type of thing.
Which he did do. Yeah, he violated a guideline, which is basically, well, I believe the guideline was that if you do something to cost Blizzard,
oh, Okay.
Money. Well, essentially, if you did something to deface.
Defame Blizzard. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm a caster. Like if I was to say something totally insane in a StarCraft cast, like they don't have to pay me basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. And that it was punitive in that they took away his password. I thought that was a little bit punitive. But in terms of your question, I think it's going to be really interesting when you throw politics into things, because as you said, what I think is so wonderful about gaming, and for me, like what I see in the FGC, is that it transcends politics. For instance, as you know, there's this whole trade war going on between Japan and Korea. I mean, it's gotten pretty, I don't know about violent, but like the sentiment in Korea is like pretty anti-Japanese.
I can't buy Japanese beer right
now. So
they won't let me at the convenience store if I try to.
We have Japanese and Korean players and they go back and forth to the different countries to compete. They're actually good friends. And for me to like go to a competition and see people from these different countries that are supposed to be kind of at odds with each other, they just want to play games and they're having fun. And you see like, you know, like Pakistan and India, they're not supposed to like each other. The players all respect each other's gameplay. They hang out after they play, you know, they go share meals together. It doesn't matter if you're from like whatever social economic, what race, like you just, the love of the game and competition brings you together and you develop these like wonderful friendships and you don't necessarily let like politics and whatnot come into it. So, I mean, that's one of the things that I love. But then now when you start layering and people are allowed to express their opinions. In the U.S., you know, your freedom of speech, that's not true for other countries. So I can't, you know, every country has their own set of rules. But when you start layering in that, and then the whole international ownership and like power between like the publishers, the corporations, the owners, investors, it's gonna be a really interesting next. And then everyone's like uninstalling their Blizzard games, and it's just, I mean, you see this in like even in the U.S. if like religious, you know, like boycott Chick-fil-A or like no, support Chick-fil-A, and like so the power of the purse, how that's going to also, it'll be really interesting to see. I'm going to be on the sideline looking and watching.
Yeah,
it's
so weird. I've been making this joke with my friends, but it feels like I'm in a simulation right now as a StarCraft caster and seeing all this stuff happening to Blizzard and how crazy this has all become. Kind of as a side question here, I mean, a lot of this I feel is fueled by social media. It seems like we're actually, in my opinion, we're actually too connected. Do you feel like social media is bad for us, or are we supposed to be unplugging more?
I think it amplifies, and it's that whole echo chamber thing. I mean, just with the elections in the U.S., what I saw, you know, with Facebook, I know the young people, you guys don't go on Facebook, but like, because it's taken over by your moms and dads. But mom and dad, during the last election cycle, my feed was just, I grew up in the Midwest. So most of my high school friends are very, you know, Republican. And then my college friends are like super liberal and Democrat. And so I got to see both come up on my feed, right?
Yeah.
But I think for most people, it's one way, and you just reinforce the echo chamber, right? And so, and with gaming, it's most of our communication is on Twitter. And you'll see something like, we always call it, what is it? What do we say in the FGC? Something about Tuesday, like some shit always happens on Tuesday, right? You get some drama on Tuesday. I forget what the term is, but it's like, oh, if some other like drama comes up, it's like, oh, it's not even Tuesday. Like, what's going on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, things get blown out so quickly, and then they also like die pretty quickly. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound like an old fart and be like, oh, you should unplug and get off social media. I don't think it's healthy a lot of times. And do people do like unplug just for kind of mental breaks and things. But it's also like for us, it's like we need to be part of it. That's how we get our communication across. So much of the community, that's where they get all the news, the gossip, whatever. And so I can't unplug from it as much as I want to, but yeah, it's.
I feel the same way. Like, I have this big Twitter account that I hate, but I need to use it. But I've got off Facebook. I'm very happy I'm off Facebook. But yeah, I'm just wondering if people are getting crazier because of this. Because, like, what's weird about, I mean, for me personally, it's just like I am a person of the internet, right? I grew up playing StarCraft.
Mm-hmm.
I know so many people now globally. I could go to almost any country and have dinner with somebody that I'm.
Isn't that awesome, though?
So fucking cool. But at the same time, I feel this need to disconnect. So I don't want to share everything with everybody.
So that's something that you have to kind of, I think, come to a decision with as a public person, right? And going back to we were talking about how the news kind of glamorizes esports now. I think that's what social media does, especially like the Instagram era, right? You're only seeing like when they win or do all kinds of cool stuff.
It's only positive stuff.
Yeah, and like life kind of sucks most of the time, right? Yeah. And so then you're like, ugh. So it makes the lows seem even lower because when you go on social media, you're only seeing other people's highs, right? And so I think, you know, intellectually we know that, but like when you open up your feed and you're having a bad day, like it's just so... But it's here, and I do know a lot of people that kind of unplug for a while, but you and I.
We're kind of stuck, right? So what other trips do you have coming up here?
What other trips? So going back to London, we have a big tournament coming up. EGX is a, I don't know what it stands for, European Game Expo, maybe.
That's a good guess. You're probably right. Yeah,
something like that. And so there's a big Street Fighter premiere, so my players are coming and they're gonna stay with me. We're gonna do some fun content in the house. Invite a lot. One of the things I love doing is like featuring local players and things. So when we did the dojo here, my objective was to get the international audience to get to know more of the lesser known local talents. And so I still have to upload all of them to Twitter, but I just like did little clips of like people that most people haven't heard of here. And so with folks in London, I mean, they're all pretty popular and famous because they're all really good, but showing a different side of them, like having them in the house, just playing and chilling and doing some fun activities. I would like to show the other side of the pro gamer. Most times you just see them at a competition doing that like poker murder face as they're like, you know, concentrating and like whatever, and then they get off the stage and that's it, right? But these guys, like all of the guys and gals, like they're just really really interesting, unique people. So I'm gonna try to show more of that. So if that in London, and then we're actually doing a dojo in Pakistan too.
I've heard about this.
Yeah,
it's so exciting.
Yeah. So one of our guys. So I think you talked to Hassan. He's on our stream team, and
he crushed the podcast. By the way,
he's amazing. So so lucky to have him a part of, you know, part of the team. So when I talked to him way back when I was asking him about, you know, joining our, you know, as a content creator and whatnot, he was saying like one of his dreams and goals was to like help like shine light on the Pakistan community. And and so with what I'm sure you probably heard of Arslan Ash, when he like kind of just burst onto the scene at Evo Japan and also won this Evo, everyone's just like talking about like the scene, like so Hassan and I were talking, and I was like, you know, I said to him, you know, when we were talking about like, I'd like to, let's do a dojo there. And we actually did a whole event where we like raised money and whatnot. And so we're doing a dojo, November 3rd, and with a local TO. And once again, like I wanted to just that we, as we did in Seoul, like working with a local, TO, to like kind of give them an opportunity to like do something locally, but then have international eyes on it, and train the folks to like kind of the standard of some of the international broadcasting competitions, and just help the local scene like grow more, right? And so we'll try to like feature a lot of the lesser known players there as well. And then the winner of that, we're gonna fly out to the Last Chance qualifier. It's in Bangkok. And so the winner yesterday, Lohai, who's on my team, actually won the tournament. But the highest placing non-sponsored person, they got their prizes to get flown out to Bangkok for the Last Chance qualifier. We're going to do that again in Pakistan, give the opportunity to somebody that's not sponsored to go and like compete with the finalists there. So we have that in Pakistan. I'll probably be going out to Dubai, where there's a big tournament there that one of the Korean teams, Roxen Rocks Gaming, they're kind of putting on one of the majors there. I haven't been to the Middle East yet, and so I'm excited to go and see.
Oh, it's
going to
be your first time. I haven't been yet either.
Yeah, so I just really want to, I hope I can go so that I can just kind of get to meet some of the folks in the scene. I mean, that's one of the reasons I was joking that I live on airplanes, but I think it's super important as you're understanding the community that you actually go to these tournaments, meet the people putting it on, meet the local folks that are competing, just the fans, the commentators, all of that. And each scene is slightly different. And so the Middle East, I haven't been out there. And so I'd really like to go out and kind of get to learn and support the scene.
Going to these events, because I travel a decent amount to events, I'm always fascinated by the unique problems that can come up, you know, in some country where you're trying to run an event. Have you encountered anything or had any interesting stories where like they're trying to run an event somewhere, but there's some law or regulation that's going to prevent something from happening? Or I mean, if not, no problem. I'm just curious because you've been traveling so much.
Yeah, I'm sure. This is a yesterday's event was the first time that I was involved in actually helping to run a tournament. So I've been going more as a spectator and like supporter. I'm sure that there's all kinds of stories of rules and regulations. I know there's a lot of stories of players who have a hard time like getting there for visa reasons or whatnot. I'll probably, as I try to help more of these, we'll have interesting stories to tell you. So yeah
it's I don't know, it's always fascinating to me kind of seeing, because this is so global, kind of finding out these unique problems, like for instance Pakistani players not being able to get visas to go to events.
It's really hard, it's really tough, it's, for them, where
is that a government fix, is that how that's sorted, is it like the Pakistani government would need to start issuing like a letter of request to, like, let's say it's in the U.S. the letter of request there to get that sorted. I mean, I don't know how that really works.
I don't know if the Pakistani government, but I think each community, like we have this really great program that one of the members called Sherry Genix in the U.S. She's a Street Fighter player, has been really helping with, and I may be wrong, I think it's called Game Pass, but she's been helping a lot of these players from countries that have problems with visas and advising them, and so she's been able to get them to successfully apply for visas. So it is just, a lot of it is information, right? So when you apply for a visa, if you apply with a portfolio of like clippings of your winnings or news articles, or like to support the fact that you are coming in as a gamer and why you're coming, and you have letters of recommendation, or you've got all of this type of thing, then most of the time you're going to get that visa and get a yes, right? And so it's a lot of knowledge sharing. And so she's been working with a lot of, South American players, Middle Eastern players, players from Pakistan, and been having good success. And so I think something like that, where you spread the knowledge, and then those people that were successful can also help members in their community, and this is the right way to do it. You make sure these boxes are checked off. You make sure you have this, and this is how you do an interview, right? Don't be nervous. Like, she helps them like actually do mock interviews and all that for this.
That's so cool.
So the community, kind of when there's a problem, the community will oftentimes come together to help come up with some some answers like that. So I just applaud people like her that are doing that.
Just to change topics here for a second before we wrap this up, I was curious your take on South Korea and how it's changed since you were young. Because this country has transformed so massively.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when I left when I was six, I mean, we had latrines. Like, I didn't have running water. My mom cooked. Okay, so I remember, like, we had a pump in the middle of the courtyard. You had to prime the pump to get the water out. And then she cooked on, it was really a dirt floor, and then she would start the coal fire to cook the stuff. So that's, like, I say that in my lifetime, but even, like, 20 years ago, Korea had changed so much. The first time I ever saw a toilet, and it was one of those squat toilets, like, I cried because I thought it was going to get sucked up in the hole, right? So I'm talking, like, and so when we moved, it was like for a lot of opportunity and things, right? And now I kind of look at a lot of the Korean Americans that are in the States, and you come back here and you think, oh, how would life have been different if we had just kind of stayed? No one, I don't think any of the people that emigrated realized like how quickly the country had could change in the amount of innovation and wealth. And like, I love coming here because I get so kind of like, I get a lot of inspiration from all the streetwear that's happening. Like all the, there's just so much vibrant energy here. I just feel like stuff is being created and things are happening. And I've been visiting a lot of startups here on this trip. There's just like this cool, buzzy energy. So yeah, it's, I mean, I'm old, so when I'm talking to you about latrines and there's no TV and things like that, but I just look back in the pictures of like, yeah, it's just.
From the Koreans I've talked to, the ones that are like expatriates, basically, so they're living overseas. Mm-hmm. When they come back here, they'll oftentimes say they're treated very differently by local Koreans. Have you had that experience?
Well, they all think I'm Japanese or Chinese because I don't speak very, I don't speak Korean very well. But one time I visited with my parents and they're trying to order something and they couldn't get across to the waitress. And it's because they were using Korean from like 30 years ago. Like
the language has changed,
but they're using old terms from like way back when. And I find like a lot of the Korean Americans, they're actually even more conservative than the Koreans here because things have changed here and they're like kind of really conservative. But yeah, I just think everything's like cooler and hipper here. And I just feel really like, oh, really uncool. Like the other night after the tournament, I'm like walking in Hongdae and everyone looks like, oh man, they're so cool. And I was like, oh, I'll just go back home now. Like, I mean, it must change, like, for you, too, like, it must change in the 10
it's become
years
much that... more. It's become much more cosmopolitan out here.
Uh-huh.
Like, so I've been out here for almost 12 years, and I remember, I mean, I was down at, I don't know if you know Nambu Terminal, but it's just a little bit south of Gangnam, and I was the only foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
In the whole, like, if there was another white guy that got on the train, I'm like, who's this white guy?
And like, your head was like all taller than everyone.
Yeah, I was
else,
like,
but not anymore. Right?
Yeah, everybody's gotten a lot.
Like, I was like, how did these Korean guys get so
Koreans
tall?
Got bigger. I don't know what happened. But.
Like all 6 feet. Like, oh my god, I feel so short now. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's at the time it was like, I don't know. I felt way exotic, I guess.
Mm.
And now it's become such more, so much more a global city. It's so much more international.
Uh-huh.
Now.
Uh-huh. I wonder if the world's just becoming like, because even when, like, London, like when I was living in Cambridge, oh gosh, though, that was, never mind, that was a long time ago, that was 30 years ago, wow. I'm dating myself because I'm like, oh, that was before I had my son, he's 29, so never mind. That 30 years is a long time for things to change. Never mind. I take that back now.
I think things are getting cleaned up overall, like everything's just getting nicer. Yeah,
everything's like so much more international and things. So maybe that's the positive side of the connectivity of the internet and information sharing. Or maybe if you like things to stay like culturally, like, you know, more, that's a negative. I don't know.
When I left the States to move here, I was going to school in Colorado, but I was from Kansas. But I remember going back to Kansas just a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. it was like it had totally transformed.
All the cow pastures are like, you know, suburban McMansions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's yeah. all these, and there's all these hip bars now yeah, that weren't there. Right. Where I thought, I guess I left that place and left that time there as well, and I thought it wouldn't change, and I go
everything's
back.
Everything's hipster now.
Yeah,
right?
Now there's like arcades with bars, and they're playing Smash Brothers in there, and I'm like, what's going on? This is crazy. Since we're talking about Korea, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this at all, but what's your take on? You know, North Korea and South Korea and this whole debacle. Do you have any thoughts on this? Or are they just going to get nuclear weapons? Or
I hope is there, not.
I just wonder. It's always on my mind since I'm out here.
Yeah. It's like when you live in Tokyo, earthquakes are always on your mind.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
you kind of forget about it, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty non-political, but
yeah.
from just like a humanitarian point of view, like I just I wish that there were more like conversation, just because from the humanitarian point, I do a lot of volunteer work in the U.S. for Korean Americans, like on the board of Council of Korean Americans. And I know a lot of the members have families from North Korea, and they do a lot of, whether it's like medical or like hunger issues, and working with the U.N. and whatnot, and trying to give aid to North Korea. And so they kind of work at it from that angle versus, like, I don't, you know, from the political angle, which is so much more nuanced. But yeah, it's been going on for, I'm just a business owner.
I just always wonder, because I follow it so closely now that I've been out here, and mm-hmm. I just wonder, mm-hmm. as long as I'm out here, is this thing ever going to get resolved or what? But I don't know.
There's always like a little bit of hope, and then you go like, when is it, like, it's not two steps forward, one step back. It's one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah.
It's really it's heartbreaking, actually.
How did this podcast go for you? Did you enjoy this?
Yeah, we kind of just talked all over.
We can talk about anything. It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's the first podcast I've ever done.
You did really well. Yeah, thank you.
Asking me to come on. I wasn't sure what to expect. Back, and I don't know if I have anything interesting for people to listen to, but
I think people are gonna love it. Here, let's cut here, and then we'll go to the post show. Guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I think Jinhee is a really interesting person, and I wish her and the rest of the UIU team the best of luck in the future. We're gonna be coming back again with another episode next week. As usual, we don't have any StarCraft in December, so I'm totally free. I do have a little vacation coming up that I'll be taking right before Christmas. And, guys, again, hold on. I'm going to sneeze. Oh, shit.
Getting nose blue balls right now, man.
All right. Okay. Guys, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. And, again, support on Patreon really goes a huge way. Patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. Is there anything else we need to announce, Ryan?
I think that just about does it.
All right, guys. I should not be sick for the next recording. I'm sure I'll have recovered by then. Well, I'll see you guys next week. I love you. Take care. Bye-bye. This podcast was produced by Ryan, artwork by Alarise, music by Mark Lentz. Special thanks to our top Patreon supporters, Seth Rohit Sambadi, Charlie Sheever, John Kernicki, and Tyler Tebow Baggins Radsek. I'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.